Welcome back to the program. Back in the 1930s, Freud said that the great question that had never been answered even in his 30 years of research was, what do women want? In the 80 years of research since, have we come any closer to an answer? And are the things that women wanted then even remotely similar to what they want in this post-feminist age? My guest, Betsy Priolo, thinks there are, and that they can be identified and quantified. She looks at them in her new book, Swoon, Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them. Betsy Priolo, her book is Swoon, Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them. Betsy, thanks so much for being with us today. Betsy Priolo is the author of the previous bestseller, Seductress. She was a scholar in residence at New York University. And her newest work is Swoon, Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them. It is my pleasure to welcome Betsy Priolo to the program today. Betsy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Delight to have you here. Can we generalize across generations and across cultures in terms of the things that are appealing to women, the things that are seductive that men do?
Well, it's hard to make a formula for this, but here's the interesting thing. There is a small minority of men who have always enamored and kept enamored the majority of women. And nobody has ever made a comprehensive study of these men. And if you study them throughout history, it's fascinating because they do share, even though they're a very diverse group, they share some striking similarities in personality and amorous arts that you might not have heard of. And they seem to be an interesting window onto what women really want and what they rarely talk about. So I thought that was very curious.
And in fact, there's a disconnect, it seems, between what the conventional wisdom might hold in terms of what women want and what your research has turned up.
Exactly. We've been taught various ideas about what women want. The most prevalent, I guess, is the evolutionary psychological version of the desirable man. And we know who that's supposed to be. This is the alpha male with the most money, the most status, the best looks, the best nester potential. And when I went into this book, I believed that that was probably the case. But I studied, it seems like, hundreds of biographies, and none of the great ladies' men, these are the lovers of history who just enthralled women and kept them enthralled, met that criteria. It was quite unusual, almost, for them to be high-status men, for example. And if they were, they were deploying some other arts to keep women enchanted. It wasn't money. It wasn't status. Yes, you can buy love. You can buy a mate, but you can't buy love. So the men who had prestige didn't necessarily enamor the women that they seem to have captured.
The question it seems to raise is whether or not the great seducers, some of the men that you talk about, and some of the incredibly attractive and appealing women that they have seduced over time, whether they're not the outliers, and in fact that the majority in the middle is really more attracted to those evolutionary biological things that we talked about earlier.
You would think so. I don't believe that's true, because these men that I profile in the book monopolize most of the women most of the time and seem to make them happiest and most fulfilled in life. So it seems to me that a lot of people, if you look at studies especially today, 75% of women in one study are bored with their mates or their lovers or whatever. So I'm not sure that we have unions that really embrace a grand amour. But the men that I studied were artists of love, and they kept love at the very highest level, so that the women who were engaged in these relationships were incredibly fulfilled and happy. And this should be the goal, I think, of love. It was the goal of love philosophers and still is throughout time. So I think the majority of people probably settle, if that's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that they getting the full payoff in love that these men delivered.
One of the things that you talk about is one of the things women are looking for is entertainment value, as you put it, in men.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In a recent study, that came up number one on personal fun, and that means festivity. We seem in America to be fun challenged, according to lots of studies that I read, especially with so much plugged-in entertainment. So that love apparently blooms in with festivity. It's a disinhibitor. It releases endorphins. It bonds people together. And this is an art that's fallen by the wayside a lot, but I think it's very, very powerful. Women love to goof and laugh and let go with a man and have fun. And one of the reasons, according to the evolutionary psychologists, if you can believe this, is that it assures them that they're in safe company, apart from being an affinitive display. So it serves several functions, and as I said earlier, it releases all these feel-good chemicals, and it's very disinhibiting, which women need and love.
And to that point, one of the things you talk about is that men who are more in touch with their feminine side tend to be more effective at doing exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting findings, most counterintuitive findings, is that so many charismatic ladies, men, have a strong feminine streak. And there are lots of reasons for that, but it could be that the non-macho man may comprehend a woman's feelings and bond with her better than other men. And Lisa Diamond, one of the psychologists, sexual psychologists, says that intimacy is one of the four cues of female desire. What this may mean is synchrony. And synchrony lights up something called mirror neurons. And when that happens, there's this huge release, again, of endorphins, these feel-good chemicals that make women feel connected, make them feel elated and euphoric. So possibly that feminine side of their characters gives them a special insight into female sensitivities, and in that way creates a kind of intimacy synchrony that is profoundly pleasing to women and exciting, too.
In many ways, it's been one of the great themes of art and literature, movies, etc., this conflict oftentimes for women between the artistic man and the macho man.
Right. Again, I didn't find... I sound like Zsa Zsa Gabor, who says, macho never means mucho. And what she was basically saying is what I found, is that high testosterone he-men seem to have less appeal to women than men who are in touch with their sensitive side. Gary Cooper, who is the icon of American manhood and theoretically that macho ideal, is a perfect example. He was 6'3", more beautiful than Garbo, but he combined a feminine sensitivity and a feminine tenderness and sweetness along with that masculine swank. And women said that his charm center was really that ravishing androgyny.
One of the things that you talk about is that it's men that appeal to a kind of unfulfilled romantic desire. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think that women and men both have a tremendous yearning for a grand amour. Actually, men, even though that's not part of your question, men are really fronting. They are closeted romantics. If you look at studies, 84% of them aged 18 to 34 think they're going to be married to the same person forever. They fall in love at first sight. And if you just glance at any book of romantic poetry, like the Penguin one, of 360 poems, only 26 are by women. So men have just the same romantic yearnings as women. Women are just more overt about it. And so I think that a lot of the popular romantic literature that women are reading now speaks to that unfulfilled yearning for romance. Right now, we're living in supposedly a post-romantic era of hookups and casual sex and sort of romantic cynicism and boredom. But beneath that all, I think there's a tremendous nostalgia for romantic love. It exists in 99% of societies around the world, and I don't think we can repress that completely, even though there's a lot of cynicism about the fact that we can never recover that tremendous sense of love again, along with, since we now have so much easy sexual access.
Is that the appeal of something like Fifty Shades of Grey?
I think so. I have an unusual take on that. I think it's less about S&M, really, than women's unfulfilled romantic desires right now. I mean, as I said earlier, 75% of women in one study are bored with dates and mates. And here's this man who comes along, and he is, you know, never boring. He is always, always providing the heroine Anna with surprises, with excitement, with passion. And then we have sexual frustration, and that's never a problem in Fifty Shades of Grey. Also, I think women are tired now of being aggressors. This seemed to be one of the big pluses of the feminist revolution, was that women could now be aggressors. But in a way, that backfired, because it's called the principle of least interest. The person who is the pursuer has the least amount of power, so that men now have become quite passive and just wait for women to make the first move. But in many, many studies, women say they're tired of that, and they would love for men to make the first move and to be ardent and to show romantic zeal. So we have that in 50 Shades of Grey, that huge royal rush that he gives her. I know it's over the top, the whole book is, but still remains writ large. It seems to reflect these unfulfilled romantic desires, combined with the fact that women are famished for conversation, and that's also part of courtship. In fact, it's supposed to be, according to Jeffrey Miller, the heart of human sexual selection, a verbal courtship. And here we have Christian Grey, who, you know, makes this amazing pillow talk and wants to listen to her for hours, and he's amusing and charming. Women don't normally get that. And also intimacy. Women are starved for intimacy, and you may not remember this line from 50 Shades, but he says, "Anna, I crave intimacy with you." So here's a man who pays attention, and a lot of men are tuned out today. But attention really is the food of love, and he supplies that. So even though the book is absurd in many ways, and he's every romantic hero times 10, still remains, he reflects, I think, many, many, many women's craving today for a grand amour. I think Simone de Beauvoir said every woman wants a grand amour. I just think that both sexes want this and don't know really how to go about it. I mean, the whole sexual revolution left us without an instruction book. And Timothy Purper did a study of hundreds of men and concluded that the majority are oblivious about the arts of seduction. So we're getting our erotic education, such as it is, in all the wrong places, you know, sex ed classes, which are just about practicality and safety. But we really don't have any systematic education in America about love, about how to create it and sustain it.
How much of the problem, do you think, in the balance of relationships today, comes from this attempt at achieving some kind of power balance and the power imbalance that often results.
Yeah, I think the essence of love is parity. It's equality. And it's always that vibrant tension in any relationship to keep the power balance equal. And so, yes, one of the difficulties is that women have achieved a tremendous amount of power and have usurped male prerogatives. So many men are going about trying to achieve equality with women in the wrong way by dominating them. That's the player movement, mm-hmm. pickup artists and so on. But some of the new work points toward a future in which women are going to be asking more and more, and men too, for hedonic relationships among equals. So that means relationships that provide pleasure with partners who are of the same status and the same standing with each other.
I mean, it's almost as if instead of reading romantic literature, the real understanding of should be reading Machiavelli or Clausewitz and understanding the nature of those kind of relationships.
Well, Machiavelli, I don't think these men used Machiavellian techniques at all. In fact, sincerity is probably the keynote of their entire amorous artistry, if you will, because women have marvelous crap detectors, and these are men, the hallmark of these men is actually that they do cherish women. They love their company. And that's what makes them unusual in some ways in cultural history, because mm-hmm. men are socialized at an early age to boycott the girls' club and to bond with other men. But these men enjoy being with women. They really like them. And that can't be faked, so that when I talk about amorous artistry, I'm not talking about a checklist of devious skills that they use to seduce women. In fact, I'm talking about artistry. And throughout history, there used to be a lot written about this, about the art of acquiring love and keeping it exciting, keeping it hot and flaming. And this is really what the ladies' men succeeded in doing, triumphed in doing, really. I'm not saying these men are role models by any means. I mean, they have their obvious flaws and failings. But I think we can harvest their love secrets and arts and pass them on to ordinary men so that we'll have happier, more exciting and interesting relationships.
Talk about who some of the contemporary role models might be.
You know, that's really hard to discern, because there's so much Hollywood spin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to know whether, let's say, for example, Ashton Kutcher is really a woman charmer or not. But I did read a biography, and apparently he grew up in a family where he was taught to respect and love the company of women. So he is a self-proclaimed lover of women, a charmer, very intelligent, who treats women theoretically, again, you have to pick all of this up from biographers,
right,
as equals. Same is true of Hugh Jackman. That's an interesting example, because he's a man who was also taught to respect and love women as people and individuals. And then when he was making a movie, I've forgotten which one, he actually went to etiquette classes to learn the old arts of courtship, how to be respectful, how to listen, how to make a woman feel like she was coronated. So it's a lost art in some ways, and he apparently has studied this and makes his wife, this is again all part of propaganda probably, feel like, you know, the queen of wives. He's always courting her. He's a perpetual suitor. And I guess the same could be said of someone like Ryan Gosling and people like that. But I got my best sense of all of this by talking to real ladies' men today. And that may be a better index of real ladies' men today and what they're doing. They seem to echo the kinds of techniques and the artistry that the old lovers of history used. And I found that was quite interesting.
You touched on something a moment ago, intelligence, and how important that is to the equation.
That's really fascinating. Many studies have proven that this is a tremendous aphrodisiac for women, even for one-night stands. So intelligence is tremendously erotic. I wouldn't have guessed this particularly, but in many, many studies they say that it's the mind is the biggest erogenous zone, and that women are particularly turned on by brains. So it's no surprise, I guess, that so many of the ladies' men in my book were professional intellectuals, like Diderot, for example, or even Bertrand Russell. That's a strange example. He was not beautiful at all. I mean, he had this sort of rabbit-like face. He had bad breath and a peculiar posture and so forth, like many, many of the men in my book. But his mind was such a radiant aphrodisiac that he was able to capture the most unlikely women, these birds of paradise in England who had their choice of practically any man they wanted. So IQ is a real turn-on, which a lot of people neglect.
Marilyn Monroe and Arthur Miller being perhaps the penultimate example.
Right. She said, I think, the IQ was his tremendous erogenous zone.
How does all of this fit in, though, to this post-feminist culture of today, and as you said, the kind of romantic cynicism that is so much a part of the world today?
Yeah, I think today is a good time to revive these old arts of love. I mean, women with post-feminist privileges now aren't so interested in money. They aren't so interested in status. They can get that on their own. They want the best kind of unions, the kinds that these great lovers specialized in, which were exciting love affairs, which were full of fun and full of laughter and erotic excitement on a continual basis. So women are in a position now not to worry about being cared for. They don't have to seduce for their supper anymore. They can choose men for charm. They can choose men for long-lasting interest, for adventure. They can ask for the kinds of equal relationships that are the ideal, actually, in every romantic relationship.
One of the phrases that you use, one of the things I remember reading, is you talk about an originality of spirit, which really seems to get to the core of this.
Yeah. The originality of spirit is exactly what distinguishes so many ladies' men. I mean, what we want in somebody who is perpetually interesting is a perpetual evolver, someone who is always on the growth curve, who is interesting and unique and really irreplaceable. So that's what I meant about originality, because the person who is the most fascinating to us is the most unique, the person who jumps from the pack. I mean, no one wants a Stepford seducer. We want someone who is himself, with a capital H, or herself, someone who's totally unforgettable and unique. And that leads to lasting love, too, because a person like that is not going to bore you forever. They're always going to be interesting and multifaceted, and keep you interested.
Betsy Priolo, her book is Swoon, Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them. Betsy, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's so much fun. I really appreciate being asked on the show.
Thank you.